Hi, this is Andre from Mental Elf, and I am here with Recovery in the Bin. This is exciting. I'm here with Rick and Bethan and Ellie, who have just given a keynote presentation at the Mental Health Nurse Research Conference here in London. It's London we're in, isn't it? London, yes. So, Rick, starting with you, why did Recovery in the Bin begin in the first place?
Gosh, that's a good question. And I think it really came from the founders finding that the services, in particular recovery, that was being thrown at them was just horrible. it wasn't relevant to them, it didn't help them, or it wasn't available. It misidentified what they needed. It didn't support them where they needed support. And it ended up being quite a sort of a victim-blaming kind of environment. And the technology, the internet, afforded them the ability to communicate, start a group, and then it's span out of control from there. It's now bigger, and what we seem to discover is more and more people coming along and going, oh, I thought I was the only one that thought that. So that's really interesting that we're beginning to actually spread all over the place, and people realizing they're not alone in finding themselves alienated and let down and blamed.
So you're a collective, and tell us about your values. What do you stand for?
Well, we definitely stand for the service user. That's paramount. We all are. Obviously, we are sceptical of recovery, or as we have announced today, neo-recovery. We do have set principles. We are interested in developing thinking along the lines of a social model of mental distress that complements the social model of disability. We're also political. We're very much concerned with social justice and the context in which services exist and we exist, which is in fact one of the issues with recovery, because recovery, or neo-recovery I should say, ignores context, which is a fatal error on their part. And you can go to our website called recoveryinthebin.org to find out even more. But I mean, as we've gone on, we've also adopted positions on various things, on trans rights, on racism, and on medication, which we absolutely support people's position on what they want. We're not pill shamers. We're not pro pill. We just, whatever works for you, that's cool. We're also on diagnosis. We're not against diagnosis. We're not for diagnosis. It's what the person wants and needs, except in the case of borderline personality disorder, which we see as being implemented as a retaliatory diagnosis, really to kind of withdraw services from people.
Symptom of neo-recovery, would you say? I'm wondering what we said that our critique was in its infancy, and these are things that we've only recently put together, and that needs to come into our critique. See, it's developing all the time, isn't it?
Right now.
So, Bethan, tell me, before I do ask you this, I want to just kind of make it clear that the talk was really well received, I think, in the room at this conference, and I was feeling really emotional actually at the end of it, because you'd obviously all put so much into this and you spoke really passionately about it, but it was also, there was a sense of what has been lost in the last few years by this group and people who align themselves with you, people and lives and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of reflect on the fact that there was a lot of emotion in the room at the end. It wasn't just you guys, that was shared in the audience. Tell us about this concept, because you presented 30 years of research. It was a really kind of eloquent, full of literature kind of presentation, and you critiqued it.
That's how we roll.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you came up with this, this idea that grassroots recovery is something that, this collective believes in and supports, but it's turned into something else. So talk us through that.
this, the word neo recovery has been used, particularly by Mad Doggy, one of our founders, for a number of years. We did check Twitter, and she was the first person to use it in 2017. So that's why we're attributing that word to Mad Doggy. And so the word has been floated around a lot, but we haven't really sat down and described what do we mean by neo recovery. And then we thought, well, let's have a little look about what the grassroots were saying about recovery. We've come into a research conference. We need to make sure what we're saying is informed. And we sat down and I printed off Deegan, Anthony, Houghton, The Anonymous. So Deegan in 1998, Houghton 1982, Anthony 1993, and Anonymous in 1989. And so we went and read what they were saying, and it was such an emotional experience for... I know you were emotional as well, weren't you, Ellie?
Yeah, it was amazing to just see how in line what they were saying is with what we've been saying for the past few years, and going back to what Rick was saying about how we were formed. Part of the reason we set up our Facebook group was so that people would have a space to talk about recovery without being told things like, you just don't want to get better, you know, you're in the sick role. And that was whenever we said a critique, either as isolated individuals or together within services, that was the kind of response we were getting. So originally it was to have that safe space where we could actually critique. So when we went back and looked at the original grassroots and just said, this is what we've been saying.
This is what we want. This sounds amazing. Yeah.
Tell me what it's like when you are really unwell and you're forced into this recovery model. What's the personal experience of that?
It feels like bullying. It feels completely invalidating. All the stuff with professionals saying we're here to support you, it becomes... It's like, was it Reagan who said the scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. So words like empowering and supporting, they all become misused. So they don't mean what you think they mean. And that's a horrible feeling because you feel like you're being gaslighted.
Yeah, you said that,
yeah.
Didn't you?
Should just point out, it's just that Reagan said that to promote neoliberalism, but we've appropriated it from him. One thing I shouldn't mention. An activist in Manchester brought me the latest shiny brochure for a local recovery college, and I think the one word that came to me from it was infantilizing. These are adults, and they're sort of like, it is the modern version of basket weaving. It really is. But also by calling about college and stuff, it by definition is saying we're going to end support. So, you know, you don't go to university forever. You know, you're here for a bit and then that's it, off. So it's implicit within it, discharge.
Well, they talk about progression, so discharge or moving on from services appears to be central to what we call neo-recovery, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Particularly. Do you want to talk about the long-term needs that are not being met, Ellie? Because you're probably quite good at talking about that, what it feels like from people you know and things like that.
Well, I suppose with the long-term needs, there's this sense now that recovery just becomes, we can discharge you even if you've got symptoms. Like, at least before, if you recovered, your clinical symptoms were under control. Now recovery seems to be interpreted as, we really don't have to do our job at all. We can just discharge you because they've taken on board symptoms. And that's part of how it links with the policies and neoliberalism of not supporting people. So in terms of the long-term support needs, as somebody with a mental health condition, I consider myself disabled. And I have functional disabilities with my executive function. And, you know, I can come and speak today about these theories of neo-recovery, but if you come to my house, it's quite a state. And, you know, quite often my entire day is just sitting on Amazon, just browsing it and not being able to concentrate. And that's true for so many people. So many people with severe and enduring mental illness that I know struggle. They want cleaners, they want help with cooking, and they want support to sort of leave the house. It's with these functional things, and that's all been lost. It's seen as laziness, it's seen as you don't want to recover. And it's very, very frustrating because your needs aren't recognised and you're told that we're promoting independence, but instead of independence means giving us the support so we can make the choices, giving me support so I'm not living in a house that if it was a asylum the CQC would shut down. It becomes just abandoned to this concept that's meant to be great that they called recovery, but hasn't worked out like that.
And of course, since austerity, what's happened for people living with mental illness is that it's so hard to survive. Rick, do you want to kind of tell us a little bit about the kind of political dimension to this?
Yeah, well, just you know, it's well established within the social model of disability, the need for independent living and inclusion in society. But in mental health, the medical model is still incredibly dominant, and as Ellie said, there's no permanent support being thought of for people. It's all about you know, at some point get better or something, and it is very hard to get any level of appropriate support, particularly under austerity. And that, you know, we're in this political climate where we've undergone a decade of our rights being taken away, as the United Nations has reported. We're now the only country on earth to be condemned for grave and systemic abuses of disabled people's human rights. Well done, UK. You did it. It's an unprecedented... It's not a neglect. It's an aggressive removal of services, an aggressive removal of rights. It is a hostile environment. And for neo-recovery to sit within that and ignore that context is, I think, unforgivable.
I want to talk about the evidence. So you've cited already some of the kind of really important grassroots recovery literature, but you also spoke a lot about the recovery research that's been conducted over the last 10 or 15 years. Tell us a bit about that.
So, we went back to the grassroots, but obviously also we looked at the current and emerging evidence bases. And we were really surprised, actually, to find out, as you may know from our other interactions on Twitter, there wasn't actually any randomised controls or really robust evidence for recovery colleges. But obviously I knew about the Refocus intervention, and we looked into the trial of the Refocus intervention. I think that's the largest trial that there has been of a recovery-focused intervention. I thought there's an incredible amount of work that's gone into this. We've got CHIME, you know, all the systematic reviews, the trial itself, and the process analysis alongside it. So there's an incredible amount of work gone into it. But what struck me looking at the manual and the contents of the intervention was that it was so far removed from our current social or political or our day-to-day real context in the real world. It didn't address the difficulties and issues we have. I felt that it didn't reflect our current needs, but also having gone back to the grassroots and read the grassroots, it was clear that it wasn't rooted in the grassroots. As we said in our presentation, it's based on the theories of attitude and behaviour change. It's the theory of planned behaviour. And there's a logic model in the Refocus manual. And that's not... They're not our theories. They're not... So if you're going to base an intervention on that, then that's going to influence what you put in the intervention. So the underpinning theory needs to be right and proper to ensure that the intervention that's developed reflects the reality. And there's nothing wrong with some behaviour change theories as long as they're used alongside other theories. So there's no reason why the social model of disability could not have been included or whatever in that.
So just a question then for all of you. Let's say a new research institute sprung up somewhere in this country that was completely linked to no one, no bias, no kind of financial conflicts, all that kind of stuff, and you were co-producing a research program with them, and there was no budget limits, like 15 million, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, that sounds good.
What are you gonna research? How are you gonna go about doing that?
Bethan was just saying, I know the admins at Recovery in the Bin have a lot of them have been going through PIP and ESA assessments this year, and I've actually had that too. I gave up. I managed to get standard, but that went down from high rate DLA and low rate high rate care and low rate mobility for DLA. I went down to just standard on PIP, and I was told it'd be very easy to challenge it, but I couldn't cope with it anymore. And what I'd want to be researched is, well, what impact does that have on my recovery? Let's actually look at this context that is being driven by the political ideologies, but the real context it has in services on people's recovery. And in terms like near recovery, I was told to promote my independence, I was just signposted to the CAB or the welfare rights. Well, I actually years ago used to work for them in my area. There's still people there who I know. I didn't feel comfortable doing that. And also, because of how distressing it is, it's not just getting somebody to fill in the form. I know how to do that. It's how upsetting it is to write down how ill you are. And for me to get standard straight off, considering people who are dying don't manage that gives an idea of the level of difficulties I can have. And I've had no support from services at all with any of that, so that is what I'd research. I know there's been a lot of mention of austerity, poverty, but let's get down to the basics. Let's look at the actual things that are happening. My income can be taken away any time. The way the PIP works, about 2 days after I got my PIP decision, cutting my income in half, then my ESA came along, and it's taken up a year of my life, and that's not helpful to recovery. And we can't just look at empowering me and giving me confidence when I don't have the damn money to live on.
Yeah, okay. So there's a huge amount of research that we could look at about the harms that the current welfare reforms and all that kind of stuff has had. Absolutely.
If you gave us 15 million quid, after I bought a yacht, of course, the SS Unrecovery. We would actually ask people.
Yes, we would.
What do they want for a start? Because that should direct the research. And I do think it would be a lot about that, and also about a future model for how we do healthcare, social care, and social security. How is that going to work, and how are you going to access it? And all within, a developing social model of mental distress, a social model of disability, which, does talk about the barriers in society and how to remove those, how to change them.
It's great that you've been invited to talk at a mental health nursing research conference, because I think mental health nurses are probably the one professional group within this whole kind of field who are receptive, more receptive than others, I think, to this message, but also have a real course of action that they can take. What recommendations would you give to nurse lecturers or student nurses or mental health nurses working on the ground? How do you think they need to change what they do, reflecting on what you're saying here?
I think the first thing that can be done is not actually the people on the ground, it's the professional bodies like the RCN. They need to make statements. They need to be a bit more political and make statements, particularly about welfare reform, and support their members to challenge that kind of thing, and almost give frontline staff the permission to make all this austerity and human rights abuses that the UN says we are experiencing part of their fundamental work, and believe us, not just say, you know, you don't want to get better.
Yeah, the professional body level, they do need to just realise it's time to be unpopular with the powers that be and actually say some true and confrontational things. There's been too many deaths to stay quiet about this. Also, their members who, you know, some of them are doing assessments for the DWP's contractors. I think they really need to start saying that those are unethical and you should not be doing them. And I think for the general staff on the ground, the troops in the trenches, meet with service user groups and pay as much attention to them, if not more, than your, you know, management targets and, you know, the policy diktats that come from higher up.
I imagine you're all regarded by health professionals as difficult.
Yes! You could say that, yeah.
So what? Oh, they love me.
Just on a one-to-one level, how would you like mental health professionals to work differently, given that the current system doesn't necessarily support that kind of action? How do you think they should change the way they work with people who demand space to be mad?
We don't necessarily demand a space to be mad. We demand to be allowed to be mad in this current context of neo-recovery and neoliberalism. As Mad Dog said at the quote that we used, Mad Doggy in the quote that we used, that we have the right to stay unrecovered whilst the systems and services are not there to help us in our recovery. So we're not people who want to stay mad, but we have no other choice. So we have no choice, and at the same time, the support that we actually need is not there.
And also, you know, if you've got someone who's becoming homeless, and they're distressed, that's legitimate distress, and probably the best thing for it is not medicine or therapy, but a fucking home.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add, like, lots of people have asked, what can they do? And we worked quite hard on this to introduce the critique. What's going to come later, what we'll now move on to looking at, is a call to action and being more specific about it. So I'm sorry we weren't able to go into as much detail as maybe people would have hoped today, but that is something that we most certainly want to advance, and we invite nurses and other people who want to support or listen to us to get in touch with us.
And I'd also say that how I'd want people to work with me differently is not to assess away needs, to actually be my advocate, to not blame, you know, I don't know what pressures their managers are putting on them, but then it gets down to me and my expectations are too high. And I'd like them to actually say, no, you need and deserve this support. I will go back and I will challenge, and that will be on me, but I'll get support and supervisors. So the whole change should be helping people from the bottom up to challenge poor care for people with long-term and severe mental health problems.
And be honest, if you know what, if you can't offer anything because it's been cut, say it's been cut, and the reason for that is the government. So you know what? Tomorrow, let's both of us and as many people can find go out and protest that somewhere. Do that. Don't just gaslight people and say, you know, we're going to have to discharge you, we're going to have to do this or that. It's because you've got no money. Be honest about it and then go and do something about it. In a democracy, everyone is a political actor. If you're not doing it, you're shirking your responsibility as a citizen.